Chapter 43. We Build a Dehumorizer. As I hope I've made abundantly clear, senators don't get a lot of opportunities to be funny in public. Remember when Jeff Blodgett, Wellstone's campaign manager, told me to try writing a 5-minute speech with no jokes in it, and I thought he was crazy? Well, it turns out that you really can't tell a joke in a speech on the Senate floor. Why? Because no one is there. The Senate chamber is usually empty except for the speaker, a few staffers, and the presiding officer, who's reading press clippings instead of listening to you. But viewers at home don't know that. C-SPAN is on a tight single of you, the speaking senator. To the viewer, it looks like you could be addressing a packed house. But if you were stupid enough to tell a joke, viewers would hear no reaction, nothing, which means your joke died a terrible death. Still, like in any profession, humor can be a way to create connections that could blossom into friendships, or at least a little slack-cutting. Plus, it can help keep everybody sane at especially stressful moments, which is true even when the people you work with don't necessarily have finely honed comedic sensibilities themselves. Here's my best example of all those things happening at once. One day in 2015, right after the Iran nuclear agreement was announced, there was a classified briefing in a secure room with about 80 senators. Republicans were eager to attack the deal and condemn the president for agreeing to it. Plus, we were talking about issues of war and peace, life and death, so it was kind of a tense meeting. And it got even more tense as we heard impressive presentations from Secretary of State John Kerry, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, and our lead CIA expert on Iran, whom I will call simply Mr. Quimby. The Senate Majority Leader, whom I will call Mitch, was in charge of the meeting. And you could tell he was unhappy at how persuasive the administration's representatives had been. When it came time for questions, both Republicans and Democrats asked some difficult ones. But I think it's fair to say that the Republicans, all of whom ended up voting against the agreement, were particularly on edge, and some of their questions were downright hostile. The briefers, for their part, handled these tough questions extremely well, which only seemed to make the Republicans crankier. Eventually, it was my turn. I wanted to ask about something that Iran's supreme leader had said about the deal. But I was also sensing that the tension in the room was reaching a boiling point. So when Mitch called on me, I decided to at least attempt to lighten things up. Just a little bit. "Yes," I said. "I have a question about the supreme leader, who I like to call the supreme being. Now, please understand, I consider this barely a joke. But for whatever reason, probably the high degree of tension in the room, it got an enormous laugh. Even Mitch McConnell laughed out loud. Try to imagine what that looks and sounds like. You can't, can you?" Mr. Quimby explained why he thought the supreme leader, or supreme being, if you will, Mr. Quimby enjoyed the joke too, had said what he said, and we moved on. But the weird thing was the joke, again, as slight as it was, did the trick. The tension drained out of the room. Leaving the briefing later, I was still a little puzzled. Frankly, my jokes are often underappreciated in the Senate, but this one, if anything, was overappreciated. On the subway back to my office, a Republican senator, who hardly ever votes with me, asked, "Could I use that joke in my state?" "Sure," I said, "be my guest." "Why is it funny?" he asked. "Well," I said, "I guess it's because supreme leader is such a weird term to us that he might as well be calling himself supreme being." My colleague laughed again and nodded, "Got it." For the rest of the day, senators kept coming up to me in the halls and in hearings. "Great joke. Supreme being. That was hilarious." I was kind of astonished. That afternoon, I showed up on the floor for a couple of votes and found a group of colleagues happily recalling the joke. And that's when I spotted Chuck Schumer making a beeline for me, grinning from ear to ear. I told the president your joke, he exclaimed, his eyes sparkling with delight. Supreme One. Huh? Supreme Being, I said. Chuck thought for a second. Yes, Supreme Being. A beat, then Chuck, still grinning, admitted, I said Supreme One. So, you told the president that the Supreme Leader might as well be called the Supreme One? Yes, Chuck affirmed, still beaming. Did he laugh? No. And you told him it was my joke? Chuck nodded, still grinning. Yes. I love Chuck Schumer. He's one of the smartest, most strategic, most passionate Democrats in Washington, which is why he's the leader of our caucus in the Senate. I call him the Jewish LBJ. But he's also kind of a character. Running around with his archaic flip phone, barging into conversations, talking too loud, screwing up jokes. No matter what kind of relatives you have, Chuck will remind you of one of them. In fact, my daughter Thomason likes to say that the mere fact that he exists, let alone serves in the United States Senate, is hilarious. I get asked a lot, is it hard not to be funny? I prefer this question to, why aren't you funny anymore? And the truth is, kind of, yeah, I can't help it. Even after all of this, my instinct is still to at least try and go for the joke, even when it's probably a really bad idea. For example, when I take pictures with families, I often playfully put two kids in headlocks and squeeze their heads together. It always gets a good laugh. I did it once to the two young sons of Chris Murphy, a rising Democratic star who represents Connecticut in the Senate and serves as a voice of conscience on both gun violence and foreign policy. Watching me squeeze his boys' heads together, Chris said, "That's the kind of thing that would bring joy to thousands of families until one day it ends your career." I still do it, by the way. But in general, rather than trusting my ability to sort out the funny things that would bring joy to thousands of families from the funny things that might end my career, I've come up with a strategy to avoid falling prey to the Republicans' dehumorizer. I built one of my own. It's called my staff. Every member of my staff is empowered to be the dehumorizer at any given moment. Any staffer driving me, for instance, is encouraged to respond to things I say with, "Okay, that's for inside the car." Or they oft use, "Fine, get it out of your system." Sometimes there's a group decision, usually involving my chief of staff and our communications team. The chief has final say, though sometimes I make an appeal to Franny. I don't know why, she always sides with the staff. Notes have been a running source of disagreement. During my second week in office, I wrote my first note to a constituent. Ruth Anderson of Marshall, Minnesota, was born on July 24th, 1899, and was about to celebrate her 110th birthday. I sat down at my desk and wrote on my official stationery, "Dear Ruth, you have a bright future. Sincerely, Al Franken." I handed the note to Drew. "What's this?" he asked. "It's a joke," I said. "You know you can't send this, right?" "Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I thought she'd get a kick out of it." Drew pointed out their family might not get a kick out of it. Senators write a lot of notes to constituents, to people you've had meetings with, to colleagues. Drew nicks this birthday note to John McCain. "Dear John, hope you have a great year. Of course, any year would be better than the 5 you spent in the Hanoi Hilton. Sincerely, Al." The thing about having Drew as a dehumorizer was that it freed me to write anything I wanted. If Drew rejected it, I'd just redo it. Like the birthday note I wrote for Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, who had received the Medal of Honor after losing his arm to a grenade in World War II. "Dear Danny, I hope when I'm your age, I'm just like you, healthy with 2 good arms. Oh, wait. Sincerely, Al." Now, Danny had a great sense of humor, and I believe that both he and McCain would have appreciated getting something a little different But Drew was more concerned about my colleagues' staffs getting their noses out of joint. So I'd just write the first thing that came to mind, and if the note got through Drew, I'd assume it was fine. One day on the Senate floor, Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas came up to me with a big grin on her face. "I just loved your birthday note. We've hung it up in our office. It's so funny." I had no clue what I had written. My scheduler, Tara, pulled up the copy she'd made. "Dear Kay, happy birthday to my favorite senator. You're absolutely the best. The people of North Carolina are so lucky to have you representing them. Sincerely, Al." The premise of the joke, which Kay vastly overappreciated, was that I thought I was extending my birthday wishes to Tar Heel Senator Kay Hagan. Despite what I've learned about how tough a room the Senate chamber can be, I have sometimes tried to slip in the funny during speeches. Once, while working on a speech about the verification regime in the new START nuclear disarmament treaty with Russia, I came up with this. A wise man once said, "Trust but verify." That man was quoting Ronald Reagan. Drew said, "No, Al, people love Ronald Reagan." "Oh, come on," I said, "it's a joke." Jess McIntosh, my press secretary during my first campaign and my first year in the Senate, told me she wanted to write a campaign memoir entitled, "Oh, Come On," Said Franken. Chris Dahl, my driver, threatened to write a tell-all called In the Car. In April 2011, Arizona Republican John Kyle spoke on the floor of the Senate, saying that abortion services were well over 90% of what Planned Parenthood does. Actually, abortion services make up approximately 3% of what Planned Parenthood does. When Kyle got called out, his spokesman issued this remarkable defense. His remark was not intended to be a factual statement. I told Drew I wanted to go to the Senate floor and introduce a Senate resolution saying, "Any statement made on the floor of the Senate that is presented as factual must be intended to be factual." "No," said Drew. "Oh, come on," said Franken. "It's funny, and it makes a point." When Drew took the chief of staff position, he told me he would have to leave after 2 years because by then both his kids would be in college and he'd have to find a real job. I asked Casey Aiden Wansberry, who had already done her share of dehumorizing as my communications director, to step into the job. As it turned out, Casey became the most unforgiving dehumorizer of them all. Casey actually does have a sense of humor, but she is also one of the most frighteningly competent people I've ever met. She kind of reminds me of the Jessica Chastain character from Zero Dark Thirty, the obsessed CIA agent leading the bin Laden hunt, except if Casey had been in that job, we would have shot off his face months earlier. Casey cracked down on this funny thing I do whenever I arrived at the Hart Building around 9 a.m. There'd be long lines of staff and visitors winding out the doors waiting to go through the metal detectors. Of course, we senators get to go straight through, so I'd worm my way through the line saying, "More important than you, more important than you, more important than you." This was exactly the kind of thing that brought laughter and joy to hundreds, maybe thousands, until Yankees first baseman Mark Teixeira took offense. Teixeira, I am sure, was there to lobby for some very worthy cause for which I applaud him. But he tweeted, "Just walked through security at Hart Senate office building. At Al Franken, let me know he's more important than me." And that was the end of that fun thing that had brightened the mornings of so many. Casey and I had our most protracted argument over a joke in June 2015, right after the Supreme Court issued its 5-4 ruling that marriage is a fundamental right for same-sex couples. Justice Antonin Scalia issued an unhinged dissent describing the majority ruling as a judicial putsch. I wanted our communications department to issue the following statement. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota today applauded the Supreme Court's decision, and described Justice Antonin Scalia's dissent as very gay. My staff said no, but they didn't say I couldn't put it in the book someday. When I first got to the Senate, we lived in mortal fear of Capitol Hill gossip columns, which, believe it or not, exist. There are reporters at esteemed publications who just hang out in the Capitol, waiting to catch a congressman failing to wash his hands after he pees or something. You're not safe anywhere. Once during the height of the Tiger Woods cheating scandal, cheating on his wife, not cheating at golf, I was on the Senate subway and joked to Chris Dahl, "I'm thinking of introducing some kind of Tiger Woods stamp." He chuckled, "We have fun." Later that day, Jess stepped into my office. "I got a call from Heard on the Hill," she said, "and they said you were talking about introducing a Tiger Woods stamp." I nodded. "Well, did you say that?" "Yeah." "Ugh," she said, her shoulders slumping. "Then I just won't return the call." She turned to head back to her desk. "No," I said, stopping Jess in her tracks. "Tell them I was citing it as an example of a bad idea." Which she did. The Heard on the Hill story came out the next day. Still funny. Senator Al Franken hasn't lost his touch. An HOH, that's Heard on the Hill, tipster, overheard the former comedian practicing his deadpan routine to a staffer while riding the Senate subway late last week. The Minnesota Democrat mused that someone ought to introduce legislation to create a Tiger Woods postal stamp, our spy says. A Franken spokeswoman says her boss used the idea of a postal stamp honoring the scandal-plagued affair-having golfer as an, quote, example of a bad idea. We think it's a funny one. The student had become the master.